You ready to get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Hi everyone, this week I am speaking with Jared Krause. Jared is a business coach, he's a mentor and an online business professional. He's personally bought a ton of online businesses over the last couple of years and he's helped hundreds of people through the process too. Today we're going to cover why he prefers buy-in websites rather than starting them from scratch, his buy-in methodology, some of his due diligence factors that he considers when he buys these businesses. And then finally, how he structures these deals. We talk a little bit about financing also, which is interesting to me on a personal level. So I'm sure lots of you will find it interesting too. So it's a great episode. I think you're going to love it. Let's get into it.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
Hey, Jared, how's things?
Good, Adam. I'm super excited. Yeah. I know that you got a juicy list of questions and we're going to get into some juicy topics. So thanks for having me on as well.
No, thanks for being on. And I know it's early morning there. You're on the Gold Coast, right?
I am. Yep, on the east coast of Australia.
Sounds so nice. I've been to Perth. I came to Perth a couple of years back. I always remember my friend when we finished university. He came to Australia to work in the mines. He's a geologist, He'd live in Perth during the week on the weekends, and then they would fly him to the mines on the weekends. And I came over for a holiday, and then I came back, and he came back to the UK 2 years later, literally filthy rich. Like he bought a flat down the bay, he bought an Audi TT, and we're like, oh my god, how the heck is like what's going on here? But they pay insane money to work in the mines, right?
Yeah, it's really good that he's done that. Like he's done well because a lot of people in the mines will take that money and they'll go on a trip to Bali and just blow it all and then come back and then start again and work in the mines. And they end up getting into this vicious cycle of earning money and then going away and buying jet skis and cars and, they don't have the long-term approach or long-term thinking. And he's done really well. And to answer your question, when you go away and work in the mines, you do big hours and you also have like danger money and all these other, you know, living away from home allowances and all these different allowances that allow you to earn, you know, $3,000 take home after tax and all that sort of stuff. It's sometimes 4,000. It's crazy. It's good. But if you gotta roll up your sleeves to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they pay for his accommodation, they pay for his food. Like when he was there, he literally had to spend nothing and he couldn't spend anything. I mean, you're in the middle of nowhere, so.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. I came very close to doing it myself. Like being a plumber, I was like, all right, well, I could just go here for a certain period of time and just get a bunch of cash. And then I realized, well, I did the numbers on the hourly rate and I thought, well, if I actually, you know, stay here and work the same amount of hours, I'm making the same money, really. It's just that you're doing a lot more. This hourly rate's very similar to what I was earning on a job site here on the Gold Coast, but just the excessive amount of work. And then, you know, when that you makes overtime sense. And the double time and all that sort of stuff, that's what really makes it add up. But you got to choose, like, do you want lifestyle or do you want like a lot of money? Because everybody's got a different, like a different goal in life. And even people in business have very different goals, like for lifestyle or a lot of money. Because I know that if I went down the route of like, I want to be a billionaire, then a lot of other things would suffer in my life, like health, relationships, family, everything. So, you know,
yeah,
it's different horses, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you hinted upon it there. Obviously, your background is a plumber, but can you tell us a little bit more about kind of what you did before you began your online journey?
Yeah, I did a lot of travel. So I did what your buddy did, but I went away and blew the money. Not buying fancy things and you know, liabilities, but I spent my money on experiences. And I wouldn't say blew the money because it has been probably one of the best personal development tools for me is traveling. And so I went away and I'd save up a bunch of money through work. I'd go away for a 6-month trip and then come home and then do a 12-month trip or a year and a half trip. And so I did a lot of traveling in between my job. But early on, like before I even went traveling, I just really disliked work. I was working big hours as well, but I was working, you know, an hour and a half away from home. So I would spend that time in the car to and from work trying to, like, you know, just trying to get to work and from work and not getting paid to sit in the car as well. So I spend like 18 hours in the car commuting per week and be tired and just having micro sleeps on the way to work in front of the wheel. And I just dislike the work a lot. And that really drove me to go, all right, I need to do something different, which drove me to the travel. Because, and now that I look back in hindsight, what the travel did is I was just running away from my job and the lifestyle I had because of work, I was drinking heavily. I was basically running away. And then one of my trips, then I had the epiphany of like, okay, cool. I need to do something differently.
So on these trips, were you working while you were traveling, or did you save up a ton of money and then you went away? And like, how were you funding these trips?
Yeah. So through this period, through like 2009 to 2015, 16, even before like 2012, 11-ish, the Aussie dollar was really good. It was really strong. And so I'd save up Australian dollars and I'd go to Canada or in America or Asia, and I'd have a lot of money and I'd just work it as a plumber. And then on one of my second last big trips, I did a little bit of work. I went and worked in Egypt as a dive master. Now, I wasn't making much money. I was making like $25 a dive. I think per student actually it was. But it was small bickies. It was enough to stay in the position that I was in Egypt. But most of it was from working previously.
Okay. And where's the best place you've been? You're obviously very well traveled. Where was your favorite trip?
This is a good question. It depends on what you, there's different places I like for different reasons. I love Mexico because of the food. I love the culture and I love surfing. Like that's a very high priority for me. And so Mexico and Central and South America for surfing. I actually lived in Panama for a little bit and did some surf coaching and stuff. I also love Japan for the culture and for snowboarding. And it's a hard one. It's really, really hard to pick. I've still got a big bucket list there, I'll tell you that much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm jealous just listening to these couple of places you mentioned here, to be fair. I've never been to Mexico. I've never been to Panama. I've never been to Japan. So yeah, these all sound great, to be fair.
Mm. Yeah, it's fun. It's really fun. It's a different type of travel. I did it all on myself, like a solo traveler. Now being with a partner, I'm looking forward to a different type of travel. Like what I really value highly in life is experiences. And you can have experiences with just random people. Like I had like some of the experiences that I've had with people that I'll tell people a story and they're like, yeah, come on, pull the other one. Like they don't believe it. And it's really hard to share that experience or that story unless you were there. And so when you have an experience, it's amazing to reminisce that yourself. But when you reminisce an experience with somebody you love, so either a friend, a partner or family member, is that's like this, that's to me, that's super valuable. That's the source to life. Like that's one of the most valuable things you can have is experiences with the people you love. So I've done some travel with my partner. I just look forward to more of that and different type of travel.
No, that sounds awesome. Building memories for the future with someone you love. It sounds, it's great. Yeah. Okay. So you were doing lots of traveling. You were kind of working in between traveling and kind of just making enough money to survive and do your trips. How did you make your first dollar online? Like how did you go from that type of lifestyle to thinking, hold on, I can make some money online here and not have to work? How did you come across that? Was it the typical way people do it, where they literally Google like, how do I make money online? Or did you stumble into it another way?
I was in, like I said, on one of those trips, the epiphany came to me, I need to do something differently, right? And so I was living in Egypt and I was working as a dive master and just taking people scuba diving, you know, almost every single day. And I was like, all right, I can't go back to plumbing. I've done this cycle of save up, go work, save up from work, go travel, and then come home with little money and go, oh, I need to do the plumbing thing again. Like I can't go back to that lifestyle. Like I can already see that I'm running away from my life that I created. So I need to create a better life. And so I was like, all right, I could go away and travel and get a job everywhere I go. And I know that I can do that through being a surf coach or being a dive master, or even if I became a snowboard instructor, which I thought about doing. And I was like, well, then I'm going to need to apply for a job, get a job every single place that I go. And, you know, I'm going to be out of money for a certain period whilst I travel, and it's not going to pay very well. And I thought, well, how can I keep traveling and make money? And that's what I did. I was like, well, sure, I can do something online. And a lot of people like I've been talking about is like, yeah, we need to get online to like make an income online, because that's like, you know, that's where things are going. Like that's the internet. That's what, you know, we can use this as a tool. And so I was like, all right,
These were other travelers saying that, right?
Other travelers and friends at home as well, who were travelers, you know, too, and are travelers. And so I was like, all right, I did. I grabbed my MacBook and I was like, all right, how to travel the world and make money online. So it wasn't just like how to make money online, but I did use Google and I did search how to travel the world and make money online. And what popped up was travel blogs.
Yeah.
And it was overwhelming. I was like, all right, cool. And being in my nature, when I'm going to do something, I'm doing it. Like it's done. It's happening. So I was like, all right, cool. Yeah. I'm going to pick one thing and I'm doing it. And I found it. I was like, all right, travel blogging. I love traveling. I love talking about traveling. I can do this without having to like come home and share my stories with my friends who actually don't want to hear about it, because the whole jealousy thing and stuff like that. Like, and plus when you go home and you have all these stories, people want to hear about it, or like want you to say some things just to be like, yeah, cool, I'm a good friend. And like, I've I'm happy you had a good trip. But like deep down, you don't want to hear about somebody's amazing story when you're like itching to get away. So I couldn't really share my experiences of travel with my friends anyway. So I could do it on paper and blog about it. And so that was a real struggle. Like to answer your question, how did I make my first dollar online, was took me a long time with travel blogging. And I realized travel blogging just wasn't going to get me to where I wanted to be income wise or replace my income as a plumber, because everybody with an iPhone was going to become a travel blogger. Everybody that, you know, Instagram started blowing up and people would consume content on Instagram more than the read a travel blog. So I was doing travel photography, all that sort of stuff, but I made a couple of dollars through travel blogging. And I thought, if travel blogging isn't going to work because the competition's so high, then I need to go away and create like I need to sell products. Like, I need to sell some products online. So I was like, all right, I'm going to become a dropshipper. So I started my own dropshipping company and made a couple of dollars through that, sold a few things, still struggled. Like, I admittedly, like, it was, I knew nothing about digital marketing. So I started up a store, and if you build it, they won't come. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not what people say is you need to have
it's
an
not
audience.
What they see. Yep.
Yeah. You need to have an audience, and you need to be able to market to that audience and connect with that audience and provide value to them through your products. And I didn't even know anything about digital marketing, paid ads or anything like that. So it was a great thing for me to start this and realize that I was a complete rookie. So I knew a lot about SEO, and I started learning a little bit about digital marketing, and that's what led me to the buying businesses. Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. No, that's a great background, a great introduction there. Interestingly, I think people always try and start out sites that they are very passionate about, obviously travel being one of your passions, but 9 times out of 10, it's not necessarily the correct place for them to start. And it sounds like you realize that pretty quickly, but some people pour years into this. They just poo at passion projects, and then they don't get where they want to be just because they've picked the wrong topic to start with. So it's good to hear that you figure that out pretty quick and then change direction.
Yeah. I've got a bone to pick with everybody that says, you know, the profit is, you know, the profit, you know, your passion is in your profit, or your profit's in your, I don't know which way it goes around, but like,
yeah,
I look at things very differently now as I evolve, and as my mindset and my philosophies and approach to investing and life changes, that I look at the whole passion thing very, very differently. And I mean, you may have read one of my emails or pieces of my content, but there's something about, you know, following your passion in work that it can be good, but it can be very dangerous as well. And people don't understand the pros and cons to, you know, starting a business that you're passionate about. And the pros is that you get to do what you love, right? But the con, and you can evolve it how you want, but you can do that with any business, any niche, any industry, because you can have passion within different things, right? Like, my partner is, she's a kinesiologist, and she's passionate about like having a great relationship. I'm very, you know, I've got some passion around having a great relationship, but I'm not as passionate that I'm going to do, you know, like read every single book about it and listen to every single podcast and of every hour of every day. Not that she's that, you know, to that extent, but like I can find passion in that and still, you know, thrive by having a great relationship, but I don't go to the extent that my partner does. And it's the same with plumbing. It's like, I had some passion within just some of the tasks that I did within plumbing, but you know, most of it I hated. But imagine if I could go, all right, I'm going to just, if I owned a business or I owned that plumbing business, I only like this part about plumbing and organizing things with other tradies, right? And I was really good at that. What if I just dropped out all the other stuff that I hated, I disliked and didn't want to do, and just focused on the parts that I did like in the business because I'm passionate about that type of work, not just the type of industry. So passion isn't just like, what niche should I be in? It encompasses a whole lot. And I mean, in your business, I'm sure that you don't do some of the things that you don't like doing or you're not great at. For me, I can't edit a podcast. I wouldn't know how, and it doesn't interest me at all. I'm not passionate about that. But what I am passionate about is doing what I'm doing right now, is speaking to you and podcasting, all that sort of stuff. So I think how we view our passion needs to be understood a bit better, and we need to really be conscious of like what a passion is and what we can be passionate about and why we should be passionate about something and how it can actually serve us, and also how a passion can be negative, you know, how being passionate about one thing in business can be negative as well. Because if you own a business, say if I own a business in, you know, surfing, like surfing is huge for me. If I owned a business that was failing and it was in the surf industry, I'm going to keep that business going, and I'm going to be pouring money into that business because like I don't want it to fail because I love surfing, and maybe a part of my identity is attached to that, you know, and that's a dangerous thing as well.
Yeah.
And I might lose a part of myself, or might lose who I am or a part of my identity. And this can happen unconsciously and people don't understand or realize it, but it can be a trap because we can just keep pouring money into something that's losing. And that's the danger with a passion. And
Yeah, that makes sense.
Sorry to get on my high, that makes sense. High, and I think, you know, high pedestal there, because I just wanted to, I think we need to really be conscious of, like, what, you know, what, you know, is a passion, following our passion to profits, is that the right way? Who knows?
Well, you're passionate about that. So
yeah, exactly. You can tell.
Yeah, right? I'm from a practical perspective. Yeah, from a practical perspective, one thing that we typically tend to find when working with clients who are passionate about certain niches, for example, is they tend to be perfectionists rather than, you know, the whole thing of get it done and get it out there and come back and polish up later. They want everything done perfect first time because, like you say, they feel it's part of their identity, of who they are, that it needs to be perfect if it's coming from them because this is their thing. And what they typically end up doing is not getting very far with the project because, you know, they just take too long in essence.
Yeah.
So yeah, 100% agree with you there. So you did that and then you moved on to buying a business. So you tried the travel blogging, you tried the drop shipping, and then you moved on to buying a business. And I've got a quote here that I absolutely love. It's, I realize if 90% of startups fail, why can't I just buy one that's past that 90% failure point? And I've never really thought about that. Like, I've bought and sold tons of sites in the past, but I've never actually thought of it from that angle before. I think it's a great angle to think about. But I guess my question is, especially when it relates to online businesses, is how do you know if a content website or an affiliate website is past that point of failure? Especially in today's current climate where you've got, you know, Google updates or affiliate commission changes, like businesses can fail overnight almost online. How do you kind of determine where that, or what a good business looks like essentially then?
Yeah, that's an amazing question. So how I transfer, that quote is what made me sort of, I wouldn't say the quote, I came up with the quote, but the fact that I found out about the 90% startups was what actually led me to, like, all right, I need to buy a business here. And I was actually plumbing at the time, and I was still trying to get my travel blog going, still trying to get my dropshipping business going. And I found that fact, and that's when I came up with that quote. And then when I started to look for businesses, I was like, your question is, how do I find out which one is past that 90% failure rate? And there's multiple things. So the reason a lot of businesses fail is because they, you know, the owners don't know how to take it to the next level, right? Or they give up on it. And also it's, you know, there's so many reasons, like competition and getting it off the ground. Getting it off the ground is exceedingly hard compared to what everybody out there who's, you know, teaching you or trying to sell you that an Amazon course to start an online business. It's super simple, cheap and easy. It's just not. It takes some serious time, money, effort and energy and some serious thinking. And so to know if a business has passed that 90% failure rate, we kind of need to do our due diligence and look at a fair few things. What I do tell people is that if you're going to buy a business that's under the $10,000 price range, it's probably not making much money and it's probably struggling already. And you are probably going to struggle to grow that business and monetize it because you don't have much income to play with. You'd need to keep investing to ensure that you eventually, over some period of time, and it may be years, to be able to start earning a decent return on your investment. To find those businesses that are past that 90% failure rate is, I'd say you do want to buy something over the $10,000 price range. And I'm not saying you need to buy something for $1 million. You can play in between that range, but you need to do your due diligence to see, you know, how long has that business been making money, right? What's the predictability of the growth of the business? What's the predictability of the business being sustainable against the environment that it's in, being online with? I'm not just, you know, Google, like you say, content sites, there's Google updates that happen which wipe out sites, and I've seen many people be wiped out. And it's not just Google, it's other environments as well. Like if you have an e-commerce business, if you are 100% your marketing is through Facebook or Instagram and they shut down your advertising account, which has happened to me, then you lose all of your source of revenue. So single source dependency is one big thing that I like to look for when I'm doing due diligence. Single source dependency on traffic, single source dependency on clients. So if you've just got one client, like, you know, say a client could be an affiliate program like Amazon, right? That's single source dependency. And it could be also if you just got like a marketing agency and you have just one or two clients and you lose one, you lose 50% of your business. So single source dependency on anything is one really good thing to check when you're doing due diligence to see if it's going to sustain where it's at. And does that answer the question? I don't know if, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think that's good. And I think at least in our small space of buying and selling kind of just pure affiliate sites, we are very guilty. I'm especially guilty of this, of buying sites that are dependent on one source, be that traffic from Google typically, or be that revenue typically from an affiliate program. I don't really look outside of that. And you're right. Updates come and they wipe sites out, or Amazon commission changes happen. I was literally in the process of buying a site when the last commission change happened. Yeah. And if I'd gone through that purchase, I would have lost half of my capital overnight, pretty much. So it was in the category that dropped in half.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's not your fault either. It's because it's the norm and it's what everybody's doing. Mm. And we tend to just follow the crowd, right? If somebody's lining up for something that is a delicious ice cream, it may look good. Everybody's lining up for it. And then we go away and we stand in a line, we find out and we buy the ice cream, find out it's not really what we thought it was, right? Like, we're just following everybody. And it's the same with the space, the online spaces. We just follow everybody and we don't do our own independent thinking. I love to go deep and I love to think differently compared to most people. And when you do that, you can find little things that can be risks involved with it. And, you know, my message is to, you know, for everybody looking at buying their first business or buying a content site, is that you really want to have somebody that understands what's involved with the content site to look at it before you purchase it, or to at least lend some sort of advice. Because you know, even if you weren't to have just single source dependency on Amazon or Google traffic, there's other things that can be a risk as well, right? Like links and all these different things that is just like, oh yeah, I'll just buy a site and it's got a PBN, or it's got some dodgy backlinks, I'll just do a disavow, and content audience, all these things that people don't really get or don't really know about is a risk. And I think the days of just buying or just starting an affiliate site and chucking some articles up, and you would see this too, is like it's gone. And I'm glad it's gone, because it's not doing a good service to the internet and to people that are using it. So yeah, good on you for not buying that business though as well.
Oh, honestly, the money was in escrow and I was really lucky that the buyer allowed me to kind of pull out there. From the sites that I see, kind of like the deal flow that I see, lots of these sites do typically tend to have like single dependency, whether it's traffic or monetization. Are you a fan of still buying those types of sites, but then quickly de-risking by adding another, you know, traffic source or trying to add another program? Or are you specifically just only looking for sites that are already set up that way, so it's less hands off for you?
It's a great question. Look, I would prefer to buy a business that has less risk. That's my goal, is to buy a business that has less risk. A lot of people try to buy a business, and a lot of people that join my community, like, look at the opportunity here. Like, I don't care about the opportunity, because there's opportunity everywhere. That's abundant, right? I look at the risk, and you're not taking on opportunity, because opportunities can change and come and go. Right, what you are taking on is the business and acquiring some level of risk. And I would prefer a business that has less risk, to answer your question. Yes. Have I bought businesses that have single source dependency before? Yes, I have. That's an educated decision based on the risk and how quickly it would take me to reduce or minimize that risk where I've bought businesses that have single source dependency on traffic and gone, all right, cool. I know that I can build out another, you know, traffic stream here. And I can do that in multiple ways, right? So either Pinterest or email list. And I can actually, I'd prefer to own the traffic through an email list and get people from traffic from Google and from Pinterest onto my email list and not be reliant on traffic from external sources. So yeah, I mean, I will purchase a business that I can, so I won't purchase a business that has a lot of risk that can't be removed, or it's going to take a long time to remove. I will purchase a business that has, well, I mean, all businesses have risk, but a business that has some level of risk, but I can see within a predictable time frame how long it will take me to reduce or minimize that risk to a position that I feel comfortable in or holding and carrying that business.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah, that makes total sense. And I must come at this from a slightly different angle than you do, which is interesting, in that cool. I will sometimes actively look for risk if I feel that I can get a good deal, if I then feel I can de-risk it quickly enough. And typically for me, de-risking is not about taking away the single source dependency, but it's about fixing issues. So if I'm happy to buy a site that's been in decline for 6 months, if I feel that it's got certain technical issues or content issues or, you know, issues which I feel I can fix fairly quickly and turn that site around, I just don't have the experience of buying a site and then adding email marketing or Pinterest. I've never done that. But yeah, it's interesting how two different people can see the same deal and I'll see risk somewhere and you see it in a totally different place. I love that. I love this kind of stuff.
It is great. I mean, you've got a level of experience and you've got a whole business that can do this, that you can go, all right, cool. I know content and I know that this isn't up to scratch. And I know that if I recreate the content or update, refine it, whatever you want to call it, but if I do a content audit and, you know, make the content far superior, it's going to be superior than a lot of other, you know, websites in that space. And just by you doing that, you can grow. I mean, you can get a higher multiple for the business. And what I like to tell people is that stop thinking about opportunity, right? Opportunity is everywhere. It's abundant. Start thinking about how can you minimize risk? Because it's going to be, even if you do want to buy websites, grow them and flip them, in fact, the best way to grow them is to reduce or minimize risk. And if you were to just do one of those tasks, you will get a higher multiple. Like you said, if you go away and make the content, you know, less risky against Google updates, that business is going to be more valuable. Yeah. And you can achieve a higher return on your investment. And that's actually a risk minimization strategy, but also a growth strategy, an opportunity as well. So I think the thought about looking for opportunity independently in of itself is crazy. I think look for risk. Yes. That does provide, you know, minimizing or reducing risks that does provide value, increases the value of the business. And if you just to remove risk and flip businesses that way, you can win. And also it's a better strategy in my opinion, because when you reduce the risk, you have less risk to carry until the point that you do sell the business.
Yes. I think that's a great way of looking at it. That's very well put, Jared. Very well put. So you started buying these businesses, and I don't think you exited many, right? So my methodology is to buy and flip, and me and Mark have talked about this on previous podcasts. His methodology is to buy and hold, and I think you're firmly in that camp. And from what I can see, you kind of use the snowball method where you buy a site, you use the cash flow to buy another one, and then you use the cash flow to buy another one, and so on and so forth. What do you think the benefits are of doing that versus kind of selling to realize big chunks of capital, or even just trying to raise some, you know, once you've done it once and you've got a proven model, trying to raise some capital from friends or family or from elsewhere to try and just go all in big? Like, what's the benefit of this snowballing method?
It's a great question. And I have actually sold sites before as well. So But I do like to stay to the long-term approach, right? Like I like to – my reason behind and what I believe is a good strategy, and different horses for different courses, some people love the flipping method, some people don't. What I believe is that why it's good to invest for the long term is because there's a lot of cons that are against buying and flipping. So when you buy and flip, that what you're doing is you're buying something. First of all, let's go through the whole process. You buy something, you do the research, you do the diligence. It takes you a fair bit of time to find that business, right? And then you purchase that business, yeah. And then you need to learn that niche. You need to learn that business model if it's different. And then you need to reduce risk and grow the business. And then you need to go away and list the business for sale, find a seller, go through the whole process of speaking to all these people that want to buy your business, find the right amount of money and the right person that's to carry the business, and then you sell it. And then you start that whole process again, back to the drawing board. All right, I need to find another business, right? When you exit the business, you also pay a commission, yeah. Right? You pay a commission and then you go away and you follow this whole process again, find another business, do the due diligence, and you might do due diligence on like 40 sites before you buy the right one. You can always earn more money, but you can't earn more time. And the time and the money together compounded over time is you're spending a lot of time doing due diligence. You're spending a lot of time learning a new business model. You're spending a lot of time optimizing a business, and you're spending a lot of time selling, and then you're spending a lot of money on the exit fees. The second and third order consequences of that and the compounding effect of that over 10 years can be quite drastic. Over 20 years, 30 years can be quite drastic. And this is the same even if you are thinking about day trading and Forex and crypto and whatever you're into, all these other different strategies of investing. That adds up. And I see that in people that buy one stock and they hold it for 10, 20 years are going to, usually have the same level of performance, the same level of ROI on average than somebody that spends 12 hours a day day trading for that 10 to 20 year period. The person that doesn't spend their time, effort, energy looking for trades and doing all this sort of stuff, in my opinion, wins because they have a far less stressful life. It's far easier and they make the same amount of money. So for me, when I buy one business, is I can learn that one business. I can hold on to it. I don't need to keep looking for more businesses, and that I can use that money for cash flow to pour into other less risky investments like property. And then I can use that to purchase more businesses as well. And when one business is like, I'm not spending enough time on that business, or it's not a priority for me, then all right, let's give this to somebody that's going to do more justice for that business. So that's my reasoning and my philosophy around the longer term investments. It's just for my brain, I don't want that much. Like I'm optimizing my life for not more money. Like I said before, I don't need to be a billionaire. I'm optimizing my life to be far less stressful, far easier. And that's what I want. If you do want to work hard, then you can do it the other way.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. And I often look at Mark and, I'm running around trying to buy a site and then do it up and sell it and that kind of stuff. And Mark's just there chilling. He's got his portfolio of sites and, it's reliable. It's growing month on month. And he doesn't really touch much of it. I mean, we've got a team that we can put to work on sites and stuff. But yeah, I actually need to go away and sit down and actually figure out how much time in terms of hours I'm spending doing this kind of stuff. It's when you do something that you love, it doesn't feel like a job, but you're right. I'm literally spending hours doing this kind of stuff. I don't actually know how long, so I've never thought of it like that.
Well, I mean, when you do something you love, it doesn't feel like a job if you don't do it that often, right? If you don't spend that much time doing it. But I can guarantee you, if you're going to go, for me, and I've done this before, if I'm going to serve 12 hours a day for work, it becomes a job. And it's not as fun as what it was. I mean, imagine if I just surf 2 to 3 times a day, 2 to 3 hours a day, every day, I'm going to have far more fun doing it, and I'm going to have far better performance, right? I'm going to and I'm going to have far better results if I'm trying to optimize to become a pro surfer, because I'm not doing it so damn much. And I think people forget about this great book here, The One Thing by Gary Keller, is that if you've got too many focuses all at once, like, how can you give the justice to a business that really needs it, that that you're trying to turn around? And I mean, you can just buy, you know, you can just buy one business, spend the time on it, flip that and do that, and then wait till that's sold till you buy another one, which is, I'd say that's probably the best thing to do, rather than having multiple sites you're trying to do at once, unless you've got leverage and value, a valuable team. But I mean, there's no right or wrong way. You know, some, like, my brother loves being active and loves doing a lot of things. I'm just not like that either.
No. Yeah. I think that's great insight. So I guess between the sites that you've bought, and then obviously the sites that you help your students with and the community with, you've probably done due diligence on hundreds and maybe even thousands of sites. Like, a lot of our audience are primarily affiliate or content based sites. They're interested in those kind of sites. Could you give us some top level kind of almost sniff test due diligence process? Like, what are the quick red flags that would turn you away from buying an affiliate site or a content site?
Yeah, for sure. I'm super lucky that I get to look at that many businesses. It's helped me become a far better business person. Yeah. So some quick sniff tests on affiliate sites and content sites. Red flag, single source dependency. You want to do a backlink audit, right, in your due diligence to see what spammy or toxic links there are, see what the ratio is of good links versus non-good links, and also identify if there's a current trend in links, and also ensure that you ask if there is a PBN. And when you do, or if you are going to buy a site with a PBN, look at the value of those links. And not to say that's always a risk. It is frowned upon by Google. But if you can get to a point where you can build up or do link building yourself, if you are into link building, there's some people that aren't into link building. But if you do build up links that can replace you having to pay an ongoing payment for those PBNs, then you can start to, like, you know, slowly remove them off. That's one good thing that I'd be looking for. And it can be a red flag if you've got some pretty non-relevant PBNs that are still being paid for. Content audit, like we said before, you know, sometimes people will look at everything on a content site like, oh yeah, cool, it's got an email list, or, you know, it's got traffic from Pinterest and Google, and then they go away and purchase it and they realize, like, oh wow, like, a lot of this content is, like, outdated, or it's not great, and it's going to cost me a lot of money to just stay relevant. Like, definitely do a content audit and see what the top pages are, see what the non-valuable pages are that are not bringing in the traffic, and see if it's worth removing them. Don't remove them all at once, because you can really have a massive shock if you lose a lot of traffic because of it. So just slowly test this stuff. So, and then... I'd like to, like, so links, content, affiliate, single source dependency on affiliate as well. So sticking with the, I mean, I'm all over the shop with this explanation, but sticking with the content orders, you kind of want to, you know, see if you're really into affiliates, like, you can do CRO, right? You can look at the conversion rate optimization of, like, is it just using Amazon? And depends on how far you want to go down. But the real red flags are single source dependency, content audit, and links. And they're the main ones that you want to be checking, including PBNs.
Yeah. Yeah. No, 100% agree with that. And again, going back to the kind of risk factors, interestingly, when I buy sites, I'm looking for those two things that you mentioned there as risks. I'm looking for poor content, and I'm also looking for kind of poor design, essentially. Yep. Like, we've got our own proven template that we know converts, and, you know, I can probably break out the stats for you right now, but you know, compared to some of the sites that I've bought, just changing over to our template has almost doubled revenue in some instances on those pages.
Amazing.
So yeah, it's really funny that like red flags for one person is almost like an opportunity for the other. But I agree, for most people who don't have either a team or kind of the previous knowledge or experience, those are 100% red flags.
Yeah, I do the same. I bought a site in November, a content site, and it was just like this weird theme. It was getting decent traffic and decent revenue, and just changing it over. Like we just changed it over like a couple of weeks ago, and it's just like, okay, wow. Like we didn't realize it would give us that much better performance. So yeah, user experience is a big, like, we could go on and on about user experience, but no, we've got a time frame here to stick to. But that's a huge thing with content sites, and I think that's the main focus people should be thinking about when purchasing. And that could be another risk as well, like how much does it cost to change, you know, the site design?
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so you've done your due diligence. Now, I think you're in the prime position to give us some tips on how you negotiate with a buyer as well. Like, how do you get the best possible deal from someone? I've seen and tried lots of different strategies, but I'm keen to hear what your thoughts are on this.
Yeah, I don't think when you're negotiating, I don't think you should just be very tactical about it. I think the best way to get a business for what it's actually worth is to be better at due diligence and to become an attractive buyer. And the only way that you can become an attractive buyer and be better at due diligence is do due diligence on a lot of businesses and look at a lot of businesses. Now, when you're buying a content site, is look at multiple content sites that are similar to the type of content website that you want to buy. And you'll start to know the market. So when you're an attractive buyer and you know how to do due diligence, you've done it on many of those businesses, then you start to know the market. And then you start to kind of become an authority around those businesses because you keep your eye on them and you know what they're worth. When I buy a business, I'm not trying to penny pick because somebody has...
Yeah.
Put a lot of effort and energy. There's a person behind this business. It's not like I'm trying to buy this trade at the lowest possible price and, you know, come out at the right time and all this sort of stuff. Like there is an aspect to investing in the right time and the right moment and the right business and all that sort of stuff. But like, I'm not trying to penny pick because if I can see that a business is valuable, it's going to be worth investing in. And so what I do is I work out what the true value of the business is and I offer a fair price for it. And I just offer one price. And then I might go like, I won't super lowball. I might be like, that's a solid fair price. I will see if I can get a little bit less, right? And I'm not talking about a lot less. I'm talking about, you know, half a percentage or like a 1% or less, you know? So I'm being very, very fair with my offer. And I just offer one. I just make one offer. And when, and this has happened to me multiple times where people that are selling sites is like, I'll put an offer forward and they're like, oh, you know, what about, you know, they'll counter offer. And I'm like, I make sure I mention when I make an offer, I stick to that price. I say, look, I'm going to offer you one, I'm only going to make one offer. I'm not moving. Like if you like it, we do it. If you don't, sell it to somebody else. So other people have gone and said, you know, look, like let's, you know, can you do a little bit more? I've got another seller that might do a little bit more. My answer is like, cool, go with the other seller. If you're going to make more money, go get more money. But I know what the business is worth because, you know, I don't need to explain to them, but I just know what the business is worth.
Yeah.
And the last business I bought it for the price that I gave because I knew what the business is worth and they, you know, something happens psychologically and when a seller goes, all right, cool, I can go away. And, you know, when you go, nah, go away, sell it to somebody else. They're like, okay, cool. This person, what happens is that seller who's selling the business goes, oh, this guy actually knows what the business is worth and is not prepared to pay more for it. what happens is that builds up some level of trust and authority in that person who made that offer with the seller. And the seller goes, wow, that person knows what they're talking about. And when they come to sell a business, if you're going to sell a business you actually care about, who would you rather sell to? Somebody that's going to give you a super high price, or somebody that's like, that person knows their stuff and they're probably going to do good justice. They're probably going to do a good thing with this business. I mean, some people are going to optimize and try to get the higher price, but There's people that do really love their business and they want to see it go well. So that's my explanation of making an offer. It's not lowball and meet in the middle and all that sort of stuff. It's very simple and boring.
No, I like it. And I definitely find people are more open to dealing with you and to even taking a lower price sometimes if you know, especially if it's a project they've started from scratch. If you explain to them how, you know, what your plans are for potentially growing the business. And then also just for peace of mind, like if you tell them that you've done this, you know, a fair few times before and you make the whole thing smooth and, you know, seamless and pain-free for them and you can handle the migration and you're happy to use escrow and all those kind of things, which, like you say, just build trust. Sometimes you can beat someone with a better offer just because you've got all those other good things going for you.
Yeah, it encompasses the whole pack. Like, you really need to have the whole package of being an attractive buyer to be able to execute it beautifully. Like you said, making the whole process of like onboarding the business super simple and all that sort of stuff. Yeah, that's huge. And you know, how you set that up is all the preparation that you've done prior, which is like in due diligence, how you conduct yourself through your due diligence. What it does is it tells a story. And so when I did due diligence on this business, it wasn't a business that was listed on a broker. It came to me through somebody and off market. And I said to the person, I need three things. I only need three things in due diligence, right? And the answers that you can give me straight away, right? And one was access. I think two was access and one was an answer to a question. And then I went away and I did due diligence really quickly. And then I came back with an offer and I told him, this is my single offer. And the person is going to be like, or I didn't go away and have to like answer like 7,000 different questions in 7,000 different emails and all this sort of stuff. It really paints a picture of like, this person is an attractive buyer. And for everybody listening, there's a lot you need to do to get to that, right? There's a lot you need to do to learn through due diligence to get to that point. It's all the preparation that comes with it, which is going to help you get the deal for a fair price.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. One thing which you've talked about, and I think it's interesting just because I've never done this before, but it sounds like you're quite fond of this, is deal structuring, using things like seller financing to help, you know, allow you to put less capital into the deal but still pull the deal off. Could you just go into a little bit of detail about how that works and how those deals are typically structured?
Yeah, so it depends on the size of the business. It's all dependent on the business and the seller as well, and also us as the purchaser. Putting the least amount of capital in, the best way to do it is if you are buying a business that is, you know, 200-250K plus is going, if you're in America, going with an SBA loan, you still need to put capital in. And it's a decent amount of capital, but you can use more leverage doing it this way. People have been known to use a HELOC loan, or a LOC loan, where you can take equity out and you can have a home equity line of credit, is what a HELOC loan is, where you're using finance as well, and you use a part of your capital for the deposit and all that sort of stuff. That's using finance. And I mean, there's other ways that you can do it, like getting multiple credit cards and, you know, making it all messy and having the risk of having to pay high returns on your repayments and stuff like that. Then you've got, if you just do an earnout, you can do an earnout. That's another type of structure that you can do where you will pay a percentage for down payment for the business and you'll pay the rest of the business out over a certain period of time. Now, it depends on the seller and the business, but you can do this over a 3-month period to like 12 months. I don't know too many people that do it longer than that, unless you've got some serious bargaining power. In this space, businesses sell very, very quickly. So most people are going for cash. And I think we'll probably get to this soon, but so that's an earnout. I would say float an earnout first. And if they say no, then do a seller financing where it's the same as an earnout, but you pay a percentage of interest on the repayments that you make. So finance and earnouts, and then you can also do like seller notes or, holds and whatnot. People have different names, 7,000 different names for these different types of the business owner holding a certain amount of money in the business until it's complete. But yeah, basically you can have a seller carry or a seller note where you will pay a certain amount for the business, but the business owner will, the seller will hold a certain amount of money in the business until, the business hits a certain performance level or whatnot. And you can do it that way too. Does that cover most of them, or do you have any other that you're like, oh, what about this one?
No, that covers most of them. And I'm assuming most of these, not most of them, all of these are kind of tied up with contracts, right? Typically it's not, this isn't just by the way, I'll give you 80% now, and then you've got to trust me to give you the other 20% over the next 3 months. It's all above board with contracts. And
yeah, so it used to be called a seller's contract. A lot of people call it an APA, which is an asset purchasing agreement. You're right. Like, you do want some contract there that is going to say, I'm going to pay you this, and this is what I get for it, and this is the repayments, or this is how it will be structured in a certain time frame as well. And it's going to include the assets you get as well, digital and physical, if you're buying an e-commerce business. But most of you guys are going to be gone buying content sites. So, APA, some sort of contract is, you're right. You're not just going to be like, hey, I'll give you like, 80 grand for this business and then just transfer it over to me.
Cool. Okay. You touched upon it just a second ago, but I want to cover off kind of like current state of the market. We've kind of been through the whole system now, right? From, finding deals, due diligence, buying them. Like, this last bit is the market is crazy right now. It's so hot. Like, I literally sold a site a couple of weeks back for 55x. Empire Flippers of posting up sites, 40 to 50 plus X. One, it's probably great for you because you've probably bought these businesses a couple of years back at a lower multiple. But what's going on with the market? Like, why is this happening? Is this a good thing for us? Is this a bad thing? Is this a sign the market's maturing? Like, what's happening here?
It depends. I think it's good. And there's some good in it and there's some bad in it. The bad in it is that, like, it's harder for people to get started because the prices and the multiples are going higher. So it's harder for people to get started and buy a good business unless you have some level of cash. But then on the opposite side is, like, because it's, getting a lot bigger and we're getting higher multiples, the bigger institutional money is coming in, which is also going to force banks and lenders to really see that this is a valuable asset class to pour funds into and provide financing for. So there's the pros and the cons of, like, it's going to be hard for a beginner to start, but then also it could be easier because you've got financial or lenders being able to allow financing for buying businesses as well. So I think it's a good thing and a bad thing. Overall, I think it's really mostly bullish and positive around it, because, like, we're getting more exposure to our market. We're getting more exposure to our industry. More institutional money is coming in, which more lenders are going to come in. It's pushing the prices of the businesses up, and which means this is going to be like more opportunity to come. And I think it will start to weed out the people that are coming to our industry that are cowboys and it's weeding out those cowboys because it's not going to allow much room for it where people will come in. I mean, what happens is when you see an investment class where you can make a 30% return on your investment, and it used to be more, people will just be like, all right, I'm just going to come in and do some, you know, buy some businesses, come in, churn and burn, and they'll end up burning bridges and they'll go away and like, oh, I can't make that much money here anymore. They'll try to find, you know, another quick quick and easy way to make money and get a higher return.
Yeah.
I think it's just going to make this industry a lot more stable. So I think it is a good thing. I really do. And the con to that is we will be probably earning a little bit less return on our investments in, you know, 5 years, 10 years to come. But I believe that, you know, the businesses should be a bit more stable and, you know, a better quality of business being sold. So, you know, how do you weigh it up? To answer your question around, is it going to continue to grow? It will. Are the multiples going to continue to go up? I believe so. There's just more and more people finding out about like, oh, hang on a second. You don't need to start an online business to make money. Like, oh, you can actually buy these ones. Oh, actually there's a broker here that shows you like how much it's making. This is like, I don't know, like how I discovered this was like just these massive light bulb moments of like, whoa, like this is ridiculously good. Like, it happens to a lot of people. I remember doing phone calls with people in the early days when I was telling people like, you can buy a business, and they're like, and I was sending them to a broker and they're like, oh my God, this is crazy, crazy good. So, I think it's just going to continue to grow and it's a fun time for us. I'm really excited for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree 100%. I think it's going to keep growing. I also agree with your point where it's going to kind of weed out the bad businesses. And I think what's going to be left is it's going to be massive opportunity as, you know, private equity comes in and they start buying up portfolios of, you know, sites within certain niches to create bigger brands and things. Like there's no real telling where that could lead for a site owner. You know, you could buy a business today and you could be acquired by a, you know, a group of companies tomorrow for a, you know, a crazy multiple because they pay way more. I think the opportunity is still huge. People still ask, you know, am I a little bit too late to the party here? And I don't think they are. I think it's just starting, to be fair.
Yeah. We've got a lot of growth in technology as well still. Like, there's some things that are on the horizon that I can't even comprehend yet, like blockchain technology. And I'm not talking about crypto here or anything like that. I'm talking about like how that blockchain technology is going to help shape how we run our online businesses. Stuff that I'm just in like the early days of thought processes around and how we could seize that sort of opportunity in terms of like how can it de-risk our businesses and stuff like that. But it's all going to come into play probably pretty quick, and we're all in a good seat. If you're listening to this podcast, you're in a good spot because you're going to be able to see how this space evolves and grows, and you're going to be able to see some opportunity from it as well.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so I just kind of want to finish up now because we're coming up on an hour here. But you're obviously an expert in this. You've done this. You've bought and sold. You've bought in hundreds of businesses, you know, between your own sites and, you know, helping other people buy sites. And you run this as a service. You run this as a community and an education center for people on your website, which is buyinonlinebusinesses.com. Do you want to give us like an overview of that program, what it's involved? Like, who is it great for? Is it beginners? Is it people who already have sites? Just tell us about the program.
Yeah, man. Thanks. I love it. It's really fun, and it's evolved over the years, and it's at a place now that it's just like, we're just pumping out people that are like buying businesses and growing them. It's really, really fun. It is for beginners, people that are like, don't know anything. Like I created my course around this to help people get off the job site. like to help tradies get out of the construction site. People that knew nothing about like the internet other than using it for social media and email and Google search basically. And so it is created for beginners. And then it gets, you know, as you start to learn the early parts of the course and it starts to get into some more heavier lifting of like due diligence and like the technical side of like SEO and like what we talked about, PBNs and all this stuff that people may not know these acronyms and stuff like that. So what it encompasses is basically it's a monthly membership or you can pay annually where you can join and you get access to like all of my trainings, all of my courses, buying online business, of course, growing online business, of course. And yeah, like the community people that, you know, we've got people in there doing like $1 million per month in their businesses and stuff like that, down to like, you know, a couple of $1,000s a month. So we've got some serious experts in the community. And the great thing is that, you know, networking with those people is very, very powerful. And then, you know, you can ask me questions whenever you want. And also, like you said, I look at a lot of businesses. So before somebody buys a business, I get them to do due diligence and I actually review it myself and make sure that like they understand the risks and point out the risk if they can't see them themselves. And then we weigh up, is this the right thing or not? And if it's not, we go back to the drawing board until we do find a good one. And they just keep sending me their due diligence for review until they buy a business. So I work with people until they buy a business. And then once they've done that, I help them grow them. So yeah, it's a fun time. It's really cool. It's really cool to see people's growth and just like the level of fulfillment I get out of it is crazy. Like seeing people from when they first started to where they're at now. It's fun.
Yeah, that's huge. And I can tell, I mean, you're so passionate about this. You know, you'd be a great teacher for this kind of stuff. So not only do they get access to you as a great like teacher and educator in this space, I think you touched upon the fact that they get access to this network. And especially if there's people in there doing, you know, insane numbers a month, that in itself is invaluable. I mean, I'm based here in Wales in the UK and like there's not really a network around here, like locally of people that I can communicate with or reach out to. And I think a lot of people are in that position. Like a lot of our clients, they don't really have a community or a space where they can speak to other people and learn together. So this sounds great for that.
Yeah, it's cool. Like they say, your network is your net worth, right? And also, you know, who you spend the five people that you spend the most time with, you know, they help shape who you are. Like, so like being in there and like, you're right. I don't have like here, I've got my community of people that surf and nobody that owns an online business. So like all of my network and connections are online and it's built through not just this community, but through the podcast. And, yeah, it's really cool. Like, there's so many things that I forget to mention. Like a lot of people that are on the podcast come in and they do trainings in the community as well. Like, and you know, suggestions from people that are in the community, like, hey, can you get this person on the podcast? Or can we do a training around this? You know, somebody's like, oh, I want to, you know, learn keyword research. And we've got three different keyword research lessons from three different experts. Like it's bigger. Like it's, I love it so much because it is bigger than me. Like it's a movement here and it's fun and they're guiding it, not me. Like I'm a part of it. Like I'm just grateful to be there and, you know, ask them what they want and I give it to them. It's like, they're my bosses really. It's so fun. Yeah.
Awesome. No, it sounds great. So if people wanted to kind of reach out to you and chat to you some more, is the best place for them to go to your website? We'll put the URL in the show notes, or is there a better way to contact you?
Yeah, go to my site, fill out the contact form, or just jared@buyingonlinebusiness.com. You can just email me. I answer every single one of my emails.
Awesome. Jared, you've been a great guest. I've learned a ton and you've given me a different perspective on a couple of different things. So really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. It was a great chat, Adam. I love talking about this, as you can tell. So thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, mate. Thanks. Have a good day.
Thanks again for tuning in and I hope you enjoyed the show. If you're listening to the podcast version of this episode, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Please rate and review as this will allow us to grow our audience and create more shows like this one. If you're watching on YouTube, Please subscribe to the channel and click on the bell to be the first to know about any new episodes that we release. Until the next episode, goodbye.